6 and 2/8. Accession number 24628, reel 4.
Sorry, you had some information that you wanted to add.
Well, we were posted from number 1 Bags at Evans Head to number 5 Embarkation Depot Perth in WA from the 7th of the 5th 41 to the 1st of the 7th 41 when we went on to the Queen Elizabeth. On the 1st of the 7th 41 to the 31st of the 7th 41 when we arrived in the Middle East. In the Middle East, we were sent to the Middle East pool at Geneva, which is on the Great Bitter Lake, edge of the Great Bitter Lake. We were there from the 31st of the 7th to the 10th of the 10th. We were then sent to an area called 103 MU at Abukir in the Middle East from the 10th of the 10th to the 17th of the 10th when we were posted to 211 Squadron down at Wadi Gazouza in the Sudan. That's from the 29th of the 10th. We were there until the 20th of the 12th.
In relation to your trip over, what was it like to actually be on board ship heading off?
Oh, it was terrific.
What were the feelings in relation that you were now leaving to go away?
Very excited and wondering what the hell it was going to be like, and nobody there to really tell us. Except it was interesting, I had an uncle on board who was in charge of the welfare of all the troops. I forget what they called him, my Uncle Bruce, and he used to have talks to me and saying that things don't look too good where you're going, I hope that you're going to make it sort of thing. And
what were your feelings about that sort of thing?
Not very worried. No, it didn't sort of, it never occurred to us that there was a problem. We were kept occupied so much that we hadn't got much time to think about it. One of the things on board that kept us interested was that we were given the job of aircraft watchers. We were given a machine gun and I had one up on the bridge with a friend of mine, and we used to go there for time on, time off. My time on used to be from about 12 o'clock at night till around about 8 o'clock the following morning. It was a long while. Up on the bridge was very, very fascinating in a huge boat like the Queen Elizabeth. And it was very nice because we were heading away from the funnels. As the funnels used to spew out horrible black smoke that got into your hair and everywhere. Up forward at the bridge, it was very nice and clean. I can't say that I thought very much of the officers and crew on that deck. They were a snooty bloody bunch that I think looked on us all as invaders of their boat.
They're probably right, weren't they?
They were. They were bloody right, because there were a bunch of so-and-sos on board that were very difficult. The AIF. I can't say the same for the airmen, though. We were rather refined. I lost my job on the bridge because I went to sleep one night on duty, which, as the officer of the watch said, that under normal circumstances would be a shooting offence. Anyway, I was sent down from the bridge and I got a job looking out for aircraft further back down the back of the ship amongst all the crap that came out of the funnels.
What were the conditions like on board ship?
Oh, pretty rough. We were in the sergeant's mess, and there must have been a couple of hundred of us, which was much better than the airmen and the other ranks that were down below. That was pretty grim. I had a cabin which had a porthole, along with four others, which was quite pleasant, excepting when we got into the tropics, and then it was bloody hot. And we used to sneak upstairs and sleep on the deck, which you weren't supposed to do. But
passing the day when you weren't actually on watch, what would you get up to?
We'd sit in the mess and read, and if the mess opened, we'd drink. We seemed to drink an awful lot, and our favourite tipple in the mess was gin and ginger beer, and you had it in pots. I think each pot cost about sixpence. But then we found another source of drink, which was less expensive and more of it, and that was beer. Toohey's brewery supplied the AIF mob on the ship with free beer, and they used to open the kegs, I don't know how many kegs each night, and we got to know some of the AIF blokes because they're in the Scotties with us, and they said, oh, you ever come down and join us. When you do, bring a pannikin. So we took a pannikin down, and we were drinking pannikins of beer ad lib. It used to actually run in the scuppers. There was so much of it. It was pretty watery, but it was a good thing. You had camaraderie there. We'd get together and talk and natter and act the fool and that sort of thing. Not quite like the same as in the sergeant's mess, where people frowned on you.
Well, things like a pastime in relation to gambling.
Used to play poker, which I wasn't very good at, but it did pass the time a bit. But I hadn't got enough money to really lay it out.
Food?
I can't remember very much about the food. It was very same, similar sort of stuff. It was quite good, I think, because we never complained very much about it. It was quite edible, and we managed to exist.
Richard, you mentioned going out to Queen Elizabeth on the Zephyr.
Mm.
What was it like to actually leave Fremantle? Were there people to say goodbye to?
There were people. Well, we didn't leave per se from Fremantle Wharf itself, because the Queen Elizabeth was too big. It had to anchor out in gauge roads. There was really nobody to see us off, excepting in Perth when we joined the Zephyr. There were a number of people came down there to see what was going on and said goodbye, but there was no family or anything. And we weren't allowed to tell them that we were going. That was the main thing. It was sort of very hush-hush.
How did that make the situation of departure?
We felt it a bit poor, but nevertheless we understood. If you stepped out of line, you could be in trouble. When we got out to the Elizabeth, we had to transfer ourselves from the Zephyr onto a platform and then into the bowels of the ship. Going round and round and round the boat was a friend of ours who had a big launch, and I can't remember his name now, it'll come back to me, but he was the commodore of the Freshwater Bay Yacht Club, and he had this big boat, and they gave him the honorary job of patrolling around the Queen Elizabeth, the Aquitania, and all the other boats that were anchored in the thing. I'll think of his name shortly, he's quite a well-known bloke. And that was his job, but I can remember yelling out to him and saying, see you later, or that sort of thing, but whether he ever heard me or not, I don't know. But apart from that, there wasn't anybody that really knew who had done what, when, or how.
What was the feeling then, finally being on the Queen Elizabeth and heading off, knowing that you were now watching the horizon disappear?
Well, we more or less said, now we've made it. We've got where we wanted to go. And of course, the last thing I think that I can remember was the big dingo on the flour mill and the big pines down in Cottesloe. Those are the last things that we saw.
Was there ever a thought in your mind that you may never see those things again?
Not really. No. We wondered when we'd be back, perhaps, but it never entered our heads at that time.
Were there rumours circulating about when you might be back?
No. No. Never.
People talk about, oh, we'll be back by Christmas or it'll all be over.
No. 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 None of that went on at all.
So you're on the trip, you're heading off. Where was your first port of call?
We called past Aden, went up the Red Sea, into a little bay, which was, I imagine, about 100 miles south of, or 50 miles south of Suez. On the convoy with us was the Queen Mary and the Elizabeth and the Aquitania, and another boat. I can't remember what that was. But on the 4th, well, it must have been, it took us quite a while to get over there, probably 3 days before we reached where we were going, the Mary took off and just disappeared over the horizon, opened everything up, and we increased speed as well. You can imagine what a lovely target we would have been for U-boats, and they kept zigzagging and all over the place.
What was it like to be seeing a new part of the world?
That was quite exciting. We anchored in this gulf north of Aden, and it was very deep water. You could see the shore with the big mountains. I had my grandfather's binoculars that he had left me, and I could look through those, and I could see people on the beach. I could see camels, and I could see palm trees and dates and all that sort of thing. And then the little kids came out in funny little boats and started diving down below us. And we'd throw coins over for them, and they'd dive down and grab the coins. There were sharks there. We had New Zealanders on board who were expert shark fishermen, and they used to entertain us by throwing a line over, catching a shark, pulling it up onto the deck with the aid of winches, cutting up into bits and throwing it over the side again, and there would be an absolute frenzy of sharks. The little boys were swimming in amongst these and catching coins. Bloody hell. There were some enormous sharks there. What the Kiwis used to do, they would bait a line and attach it to a 44-gallon drum, which in turn was linked by a line to the boat, and they'd throw the lot overboard. The big shark would take the bait and then tow the drum around until it got exhausted, and then they could pull it up. But they used to pull the drum down underneath the water. They were so strong. They were huge sharks. I think some of them were 14, 15 feet long when they pulled them up. Fascinating, it really was.
It was a real adventure for you.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Well, in the midst of proceedings, we could look up the Gulf, the Red Sea, and you could see flashes on the horizon, which was Suez, and they were bombing Suez. It beats me why the aircraft didn't take the extra extra effort and come down and bomb us. Now, this is the first time that we really realised that something was happening. And then one morning, the tannoy system came on and said all personnel are to be ready to disembark at so many hours in the morning. And we took off with the boat and went up the gulf a bit. And then they put us onto lighters, and there must have been 100 or so of us airmen who were on this particular lighter. And we putted up towards Suez, and there on the bank on the left-hand side was this big liner still smouldering. It was the Georgic, and that had been bombed and finished off. Suez in places was smoking all around the edge where the bombs had been dropped. And that was our first introduction to the fact that there was a war on.
How did that feel?
Oh, again, it was scary but exciting. We wondered what we were going into. We were landed at Suez, and weren't given much time at all. We were put into trucks and then taken up to Middle East Pool at Geneva. And that was on the 31st of July, 1941. And we were there till the 31st, until the 17th, till the 10th of the 10th, when we were sent to a place called Abakir. From the 10th of the 10th to the 17th, and I think Abakir was a staging post. Middle East Pool, Geneva, we were sent back there again for some reason. I don't know why they ever sent us to Abakir. Now, that could have been the time when they took our pay books from us. And they tried to take our slouch hats
from
us.
Tell us about that.
This
was the RAF, wasn't
it? Yeah, we were told when we landed there that we were going to be posted into the Royal Air Force. We thought that we were RAAF, and we said so. And they said, too bad, you're going to be put into the Royal Air Force. And we were all got together and asked to produce our pay books. We did so, and they told us that we had to hand them over, and they signed for them. And then they said, you will be reissued with Royal Air Force pay books, which were pissy little things compared with ours. And then they said, and you will be issued with pith helmets. We all said, like buggery. And we hung on to our slouch hats. They wanted us to hand them over, and we wouldn't do it. There was a hell of a row about that. The mob just really backed up. And in the end, the Air Force people said, all right, well, you can retain your pith helmets, but we will still issue you, retain your slouch hats, but we will issue you with pith helmets. So our pith helmets just remained in our tent all the time. Excepting, I went on some leave up to Jerusalem, and they wouldn't give me a leave pass unless I wore a pith helmet. And I thought, well, bugger them, I'll wear the pith helmet. So I wore it out the gate and then ditched it and went off on leave in my slouch hat.
The general sort of camaraderie between Australians and English, how did that...
That was all right, that was good. Oh, yeah.
What did it mean to actually have your playbook changed?
Well, that was an insult. Because we were Australians, we weren't POMs.
Were you getting paid the POMI wage?
Yeah.
What was the difference?
Oh, I don't know. It was.
I understand it was $5 a day from Australia. Yeah. How much were you being paid once you got the British?
About $3 or something than the British. It wasn't all that much. And I mean, damn it all, we were sergeants. We should have got quite a good wage, but no. It was a little difficult. I don't know. I think that business of the pay books was almost the finish, the whole thing as far as we were concerned. But then we perked up and said, well, bloody hell, why not? At any rate, the time that we spent in that Middle East pool at Geneva, it was spent in, we used to go on route marches, but then I was given the job with three others looking after Italian prisoners of war. They had been rustled up out of the Western Desert by our boys, and there were thousands of them in the camp. And I used to go down there every day with two airmen in each truck, and we used to take three trucks of battalions back to the camp, and they would dig trenches and do the odd jobs. The food, as far as I was concerned, or the other mob too, there were four of us sergeants who were in charge. We thought the food in the camp was pretty grim. And when the Italians turned up, they had bags of rice and bags of currants and bags of fish stuff and a big, great big boiler thing like Mum used to do the washing in. And the first thing they used to do when they landed was to rig the boiler up and then make up this concoction of rice and all the rest of it. And it was delicious. And we used to eat with the Italians rather than go back to the mess.
What were they like?
They were very, very happy, nice people. Until towards the end, after being at Geneva for a couple of weeks, some of the Italians changed a bit. There was a different type joined us. Great big burly types that came from up north, and they weren't very pleasant, and they were rabble rousers and problem makers. And they downed tools and said they wouldn't do any more because they didn't consider they should be digging trenches for us to get out of the road in, and that we were going to use the trenches to fight the Germans who were coming to release them. All this sort of nonsense. So, eventually, there was a hell of a row, and we took the Italians back to camp and then came back and explained to the commanding officer of Geneva what the problem was. So he sacked us all, and we lost our job. After that, we were given anti-aircraft duty, and at this time, four of us went on leave to Suez. While we were in Suez, we hit the time when we weren't allowed out. What did they call it? They had a curfew. And we weren't allowed to go back to base. We had to stay in the desert at a stop place. Well, it got bloody cold in the desert, and we only had our shorts and shirt on. So one of my friends, Mark Fitzgerald from New South Wales, said, oh, the Aboriginals had a good way of overcoming the problem of cold. They used to dig a big hole and lie down in the hole and cover themselves up with sand. So that's what we did. And we spent the night in the desert covered up by sand. It wasn't a very comfortable one, but it was warmish. It was blistering cold outside. In the morning, when we got up and shook the sand out of ourselves, we made our way back to the camp to find that it had been bombed. They had made a hell of a mess of the camp. The Germans, we used to hear them going over every night, but they picked on our camp and gave it curry. Well, we missed out on that. So, that was interesting.
So what was the feeling like, the Italians versus the Germans?
Oh, we quite liked the Italians, and they weren't, as far as we were concerned, we hadn't heard that they were ever a problem. We didn't like the sound of the Germans, because they were coming down towards us, and they were going to overrun us if we weren't careful. A few weeks later, we went on another leave, and this time we went to Cairo. When we got home again, we'd been bombed again. So we missed out twice on being bombed ourselves.
What were some of the sites that you can recall on leave? What were the things that stuck out for you? Being a soldier, being an RAAF chap on leave in the Middle East.
I was just a person on leave in Cairo. And the first thing I did was to go to the museum to contact the entomologist, who wasn't there, but the man in charge of the museum was a lovely old boy called Hassan Helboy, who was the CEO of the museum, and he gave me carte blanche to go through the museum collection, which was in a frightful state. And I told him this and told him what he ought to do with it, not to shove it up his jumper, but how to deal with it. And of course he said, we haven't got an entomologist now, would you like the job? And I said, I'd love it, but I've got other things I have to do. When we weren't going on leave, when I wasn't going on leave to have a look at the museum, three or four of us used to get together and we'd go around and look at the interesting places they had. They had mosques and strange sorts of gardens, and they had quite a fascinating garden filled up with replicas of animals, and they're all very beautiful sorts of places to have a look at. We got to know Cairo fairly well. Later on, when we went up into the desert, we used to go to Alexandria, which was even nicer than Cairo. It was clean and open. Cairo was very dirty. It was packed with people.
The sort of feeling of almost being a tourist abroad.
That's right.
You're legally at war.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what we felt like. We were tourists in the place. They had places for us to stay in Cairo, servicemen's clubby sort of places that we could stay at. And you could feed and sleep there and bath and wash your clothes and that sort of thing. There was another place that we got to know very well, an expatriate Australian called Mannering, who had Mannering's Bar. Occasionally they used to have riots in Cairo for some reason, and Mannering had a great big garage door that he used to pull down that nobody could get through. And we were then one day, there one day when a bit of a fracas happened outside, so Mannering pulled down the lid and we were stuck inside the bar. We were there for about 8 hours, which was very nice. He looked after us well and we had a ball. I don't know what happened to him in the finish, but he had been in Cairo for many, many years.
What was the general sense of the political situation in relation to being in the Middle East at that time?
It wasn't something that really impressed upon us very much. We just knew that we were sick and tired of being in Geneva and we wanted to get out where there were aircraft to fly in and do things. And we were sweating and giving the CO hell. We wanted to go. And all of a sudden, one day, we were all told that we had to pack up and we were going to Cairo and we were going to be transported into the Sudan. Is that enough left there?